Well, thank you once again for everybody tuning in to the Don and Wynn Show. We have a wonderful show for you today. I need to do my token.
How do you know it's going to be wonderful? Huh? It hasn't happened yet. We hope it's going to be wonderful.
Well, you know, sometimes we have equipment glitches here and there, and I just got finished fixing a little equipment glitch. It seemed one of the connections was loose, so we have a little late start here, but it's all good, and we're enjoying the holidays. How about you, Wynn? Are you enjoying the holidays?
Every day is the same to me. I don't know the difference between a holiday and a not holiday.
Oh, you don't do anything special for the holidays?
I do something special every day.
Well, there you go. That's a good way to look at it.
Yeah.
Every day is a holiday for Wynn.
That's right. I've been doing this for years now, so why change?
You know, we had a wonderful guest with us last week, and of course the week before. We've been having some incredible guests here lately, haven't we?
Well, I think we're doing something on the show that's really, really quite amazing, because, you know, we're creating a reality for something that's happening that is really hard for most people, including myself, for my conscious mind to really get it. And all these people we're having on, and the things that we're experiencing, the things that I'm experiencing, it's creating for listeners an ongoing idea that maybe this is real. You know, I have a feeling that the things we're talking about on this show to this small group of people in a couple of years is going to be the major topic on the planet. I think we and others, not just us, but we and others, are sowing the seeds for something that is going to be humongous. And, you know, I remember years ago when I was in Philadelphia, I used to go to New York oftentimes for the weekend, and I went into this club. It's called Cafe Wa. And there was this guitar player there.
A club called Cafe Wa.
It's a famous cafe.
Huh.
In the village.
Sounds delightful.
And there was this guitar player there that was the most amazing guitar player I ever saw. Except, I didn't realize how amazing he was, in spite of the fact that I think for the first time in my life, I was out of my body in the room. I didn't even know what that meant. But the guy was phenomenal. And I left the Café Wa because it was just such a small club. I mean, probably there were 10 people in the room. And I said, gosh, you got to be really good to be a guitar player these days. Because you think that because the guy's playing to such a small room, that's like the standard of guitar players, right? So a couple of years later, I got Jimi Hendrix's album. And I said, oh, my God, I was watching Jimi Hendrix at that club. So it's like, I think something like that is happening here. Like we're doing something at a small level. And one by one, people are listening, and it's making sense to them. And it's
there are so many people now that are out there that are starting to walk the walk. In other words, you know, I'm meeting them ongoing every day, whether by phone, radio, whether I meet them on the street. People are actually starting to walk the walk.
Right.
And I think a lot of it has to do not so much with us, but the way these energies are starting to unfold. I mean, people are just coming to, and more people are starting to become aware of these energies, these changes, and this unfoldment process that's occurring currently on this planet and probably throughout the known universe, because one leads to the next, is incredible. And, You know, I feel that we're coming into a fabulous, fabulous year of unfoldment next year.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that this year was one of tying up loose ends so that this unfoldment can start to really take shape. And I think next year is going to be a wonderful year for people. And, you know, here today to speak with us again is one of the finest individuals that I've ever had the pleasure of meeting, and we interviewed him a couple weeks ago. And
before we bring Jean-Claude on,
mm-hmm.
I had a joke.
Oh, no.
Somebody sent it to me, and I thought it was good.
You know, I always liked your octopus joke.
Yeah, well, that's not original. In fact,
put your hand in the hand of the hand of the hand.
Right.
I love that one.
Octopus, a favorite gospel song. All right. Well, we'll tell that one when Jean-Claude's on. See if he can figure it. Well, now you told him the answer, though. Thank God.
There are no answers, only questions. My
son. You know, we hear this idea that we create our reality,
right?
And that in our consciousness we create our reality, and each of us is creating the reality for the people around us. Now, when you want to change your reality, the first thing you don't do is shake everyone up and say, come on, we're changing reality. It's like something that has to change inside you. And if it truly changes, other people will change. They don't have to change. They don't have to because there's free will. But you become an example. And as an example of holding this new reality, you give the people around you the maximum chance to change. And it's like everyone is out there looking for a peer group, and they can't find it because the peer group is inside you, and it's your own transformation that causes you to change the world. I mean, who said, be the change that you want to see in the world? Who said that?
Well, I think it was Be the Ball.
Who?
Be the Ball.
Who?
Isn't that what the saying,
that
how the saying goes,
Nelson
be
Mandela.
The ball?
Might have been Nelson Mandela, but I don't know. It might have been Gandhi. I can't remember. But it's a great one. It's like, if you want the world to be kinder, be kinder.
I'm pretty sure that was Forrest Gump.
No, it wasn't Forrest
no?
Gump. So, here's a story. It's a real story. It was somebody said it on David Letterman reported it, and the email I got said it was a true story. So,
well then it's true,
not,
of course. If the email
true,
says,
pardon me.
If the email says it's true, it's true.
That's right. If all the emails I got were true, I'd be a multimillionaire because I can't tell you how many people in Nigeria want to send me money.
You know, I'm getting presidents and CEOs of so many major Nigerian companies.
Uh-huh.
It's amazing.
Right.
They know you too? I thought I was special.
Well, we're all special. That's it.
But you're really special.
You're really special. All right.
I love
you,
Ian.
Our listeners are really special. Our world is really special.
That's right.
Here's the story. I'm just going to read the email. On a recent weekend in Atlantic City, a woman won a bucket full of quarters at a slot machine. She took a break from the slots to have dinner with her husband in the hotel dining room. But first, she wanted to stash the quarters in their room. So she told her husband she'll be right back and carried the coin-laden bucket to the elevator. As she was about to walk into the elevator, she noticed two men already aboard. Both were black. One of them was tall, and very intimidating. The woman froze. Her first thought was, these two are going to rob me. Her next thought was, don't be a bigot. They look like perfectly nice gentlemen. But racial stereotypes are powerful, and fear immobilized her. She stood and stared at the two men. She felt anxious, flustered, and ashamed. She hoped they didn't read her mind, but gosh, they had to know what she was thinking. Her hesitation about joining them in the elevator was all too obvious now. Her face was flushed. She couldn't just stand there, so with a mighty effort of will, she picked up one foot and stepped forward and followed with the other foot and was on the elevator. Avoiding eye contact, she turned around stiffly and faced the elevator doors as they closed. A second passed, and then another second, and then another. Her fear increased. The elevator didn't move. Panic consumed her. My God, she thought, I'm trapped and I'm about to be robbed. Her heart plummeted with perspiration pouring from every pore.
You wrote this, didn't you?
No, I didn't.
It this sounds like a Winfrey story.
This was sent to me by Pam Lonsazak in Ohio. Then one of the men said, hit the floor. Instinct told her what to do what they said. The bucket of quarters flew upwards as she threw out her arms and collapsed on the elevator floor. A shower of coins rained down upon her. Take money and spare me, she prayed. More seconds passed. She heard one of the men say, ma'am, if you'll just tell us what floor you're going to, we'll push the button. The one who said it had a little trouble getting the words out. He was trying mightily to hold in a belly laugh. The woman lifted her head and looked up at the two men. They reached down to help her. Confused, she struggled to her feet. When I told my friend here to hit the floor, said the average-sized one, I meant he should hit the elevator button for our floor. I didn't mean for you to hit the floor, ma'am. He spoke genially. He bit his lip. It was obvious he was having a hard time not laughing. The woman thought, my God, what a spectacle I've made of myself. She was too humiliated to speak. She wanted to blurt out an apology, but words failed her. How do you apologize to two perfectly respectable gentlemen for behaving as though they were going to rob you? She didn't know what to say. The three of them gathered up the quarters and refilled her bucket. When the elevator arrived at her floor, they then insisted on walking her to her room. She seemed a little unsteady on her feet, and they were afraid she might not make it down the corridor. At her door, they bid her a good evening. As she slipped into her room, she could hear them roaring with laughter as they walked back to the elevator. The woman brushed herself off. She pulled herself together and went downstairs for dinner with her husband. The next morning, flowers were delivered to her room, a dozen roses, and attached to each rose was a crisp $100 bill. The card said, thanks for the best laugh we've had in years. And it was signed Eddie Murphy and Michael Jordan. Oh, well, nobody's laughing. Well, thanks. I think you're laughing at me.
No, that definitely was a wind joke.
It was. Well, what are the qualities of a wind joke?
Do you
laugh at me because I have a card. I thought the joke.
Oh my gosh, I'm looking at our listeners that are online, and we lost about a couple dozen.
We did?
No.
Too bad for them.
Yeah, they missed it. Okay.
I thought
well,
the joke had a very good message to it, because the woman was creating her reality in her thoughts. And I mean, everyone creates their reality, and they don't know it. You know, you live in a world where every day you go out and you see people, and you project your reality on them, and then they reflect back to you, and it all validates your reality, because there's shared realities, and you're stuck in this matrix, and people get really caught and say, what's wrong with my life? It's because they're projecting a reality.
Yeah.
And,
well,
you know, it's very tricky to get out of the reality that you've created.
Well, we have a guest today, Wynn.
We do?
Yeah. Why don't you introduce our guest here? Because I'm getting really eager and anxious to...
I had another joke, Don. We could lose another dozen people.
Then it truly would be the Don and Wynn show with no listeners.
Jean-Claude Coven. Of course, Jean-Claude was on a couple of weeks ago, and he's the author of the book Going Deeper. And Jean-Claude, do you have a joke for us?
It's a pleasure to welcome you, Jean. Thank you for being here.
I do not know how even to top what you are saying, because you are making a quote from someone who I revere very much. You are telling the people we must become the change we want to see. And this was first said by Mahatma Gandhi.
Oh, it was said by Gandhi. Thank you.
Indeed it was.
I'm glad we have a scholar here.
Indeed it was.
So, Jean-Claude, was that your joke?
No. When I would never attempt to do a tag team match with you on jokes.
No. Come on. I'm giving you the opportunity to make me look bad.
That's okay, Wynn. You did that. I love your jokes, though. I you really got it. Those octopus jokes are your best, though.
We'll save them for later in the show, okay? And then everyone can understand why I never became a comedian.
why you did never quit your day job. I would understand. Okay.
That's right. I quit my day job, and I ended up in my RV in front of Denny's.
You should have been an A&R guy for one of the record companies and recommended Jimi Hendrix. That would have been pretty good.
That would have been good, right. Yeah. But you know what? They wouldn't have heard him. Jimi Hendrix actually had to go to England to get discovered.
I understand, Jimi Hendrix was a total experience.
That's right.
That was my joke.
That was your joke? Don, did we lose any listeners?
No. Actually, we gained a few.
Okay. So, you know what? I think a really good topic to talk about tonight is I want each of you to think back when you were a nerd, if ever, and tell us, what started you from unnerding yourself?
That's asking, do you still beat your wife?
Yeah.
You mean you're still a nerd?
I'm still a nerd. I never want to move away from my nerdian instincts. I actually carried a slide rule when I went to school.
Did you?
Yeah, I did. It was hooked onto my belt. That was our badge of courage at the time.
Uh-huh. Were you a science student?
I was. I went to a school in New York called Bronx High School of Science.
Oh, that was a famous school.
Indeed it was. And from there I went to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
Oh, my God.
MIT?
MIT, where I mastered in bridge and sailing for one semester until they told me to grow up.
Uh-huh.
Suggest that I leave, work on myself, do some personal work. And when I felt I was sufficiently grown up, the doors would be open and they would welcome me back.
Mm-hmm.
And every year when I have a birthday, I check to see if I got any older emotionally. And it turns out I haven't yet. So I'm still looking forward to the day when I can go back to Cambridge and resume my studies.
I see.
You know, it's amazing how, yeah, I look at myself and I think when I was a teen, I don't know when during your lifetime that you stop to mentally age. In other words, you look at yourself as a certain age. And it doesn't matter how old you get, your mind doesn't really put an age figure to it. It just, in your mind, you're of a certain age. I don't know what that is, and it doesn't change.
We're getting hooked here with science, with a lot of things we're talking about, and it transcends that. I think I stopped somewhere between 5 to 7 years old, and I held on to the point through which I view of a child. You know, obviously you mature and what you see adds a lot of weight of experience to your life.
Yeah.
But the point of view still, for me, has always been childlike.
Mm-hmm.
And that, for me, has been my saving grace on this planet. Just being able to wake up every single day, appreciating all the little things that only children can see, and not getting so caught up in the adult world that I've lost the magic and the mystery of just simply being alive.
Mm-hmm.
Amen.
When Wynn talked earlier about this concept of change, I'd like to offer another point of viewing it. Instead of viewing ourselves as individuals that need to change, stop seeing ourselves as beings, rather seeing ourselves as points through which the infinite creation views. We are a window through which all that is, the oneness, perceives. What we see, what we reflect back into the cosmic hologram is strictly a function of the porthole through which we view. If we want to change, nothing has to happen within ourselves except to be willing to shift the point through which we view reality. As we shift that point, everything about what we perceive shifts.
Mm-hmm.
It really is that simple, and at the same time, that incredibly difficult, because we are so entangled with our beliefs that our identity has become our belief system. We refuse to give that up, and all we want to do is to find anything that we can, join with anybody we can, that will validate what we already believe.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, I wanted to add something to this. That was very well put. And as somebody that has gone through a lot of changes in this particular life,
mm-hmm.
I see that there's actually two things that block people from opening up to that energy. The one is what you said, and that is your mental belief structure. Because if your mental belief structure is contracted, you can't open up to the higher energies. The other thing, and this is a harder one, and I don't know if you have gone through this. I have, so I can testify to it. That is that we have these emotional blockages in our system that from, say, past life and this life resonances, where there's trauma locked in, where the actual energy in your body is twisted, and those are really hard to break through. They're certainly possible, but I've gone through that kind of change in this life. So when people would say what you just said, and I tried to apply it, I couldn't, because I could change my beliefs, I could have the right beliefs, I could have the understanding of the higher forces, and yet my body was still in trauma, and I couldn't get it to release, and it was a different methodology that I had to apply to myself to get through those things.
Let me offer you a perspective that might address that.
Yeah.
Whew. First thing, I never advocate changing beliefs.
Yeah.
I advocate, if you can, to transcend belief.
Mm-hmm.
To find the part of you that is not anchored in the entire concept of belief.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that seems to amuse psychologists here, and people looking at their own lives as if they were an individual having a human experience, and they say, well, all the circumstances of my birth, all my previous incarnations, whatever the miasms that are locked into my genetic DNA, whatever I carry on this thing is causing me to have this expression during my lifetime. My parents did this, I'm an abused child, I suffered through all of this, and this is the consequence, this is the cross I have to carry. Now, that is the point from which they're viewing. Here is what I'm suggesting. Play a thought game. Let's just see how this works. Just try this on for size. Assume, before you came into this planet, that you came from a point of intelligence that was supreme, that you had a vast awareness of what was going on, what the larger game was, and you were setting up for yourself the circumstances of your entire incarnation on this planet. This includes all the previous lives that you attract to yourself as if they were your own. This includes especially the genetic track through which you are going to be born. In other words, all of the genetic miasms that are locked into the gene sequences of your biological parents. You also pick the entire emotional tableau of where you're going to be born, so that you will have all of these energies feeding into you for the specific purpose for which you came. Now, if you take the point of view that all of this is not only divine, it is perfect. It is exactly as it was meant to be, to teach you whatever is supposed to be learned, or to cause you to move through and gain certain awarenesses that will hone you and make you better able to do the job for which you came. And similarly, view every single interaction that you have throughout your entire life, every moment of every day, as being part of that plan for you. Nothing is done to you. It's all done expressly for you. when you step back and watch the entire sequence, and you say, my God, it could not have been more perfect to get me exactly where I am now, to bring me to the point where I can now take action. Something, if you do this correctly, will go click. You will completely have moved out of your old patterning, and you will move into an entire new basis of living, almost as if you walked in as an alien being, an advanced alien being on your own life, mm-hmm. and took over from that perspective. Very, very doable. It works better if it can be induced, if the energies can be induced by a more advanced being that you can be with, share time with. It happens often if you read the right book that has the right harmonic that all of a sudden kicks you into action. But it's certainly very doable, and it's doable in an instant.
Wow. You know, I love that, because I, when I was younger, I took the a point of view which is a little bit different, but I completely understand what you're saying.
You know, but, Don, you didn't do your nerd confessions.
I'm a herd. Well, we're just a herd of nerdles.
A herd of nerdles?
You know, when I always looked at, since I was a young fella, I used to look at ourselves, and more so now than when I was younger, but I used to think of all, I guess, life as living emotions, the Creator's living emotions. So in other words, it's not an emotion as we would understand emotion, because we have so many emotions and we try to balance them, but we're like the living, each and every one of us is a different emotion of the Creator. And we are actually a living emotion trying to find that balance. And that's kind of how I looked at it for the longest time. I don't know if it still holds as true as it did a while ago, because I've come to different understandings. But that's actually kind of how I looked at myself as really a living emotion, trying to find a balance.
No, it's a wonderful way to go. And not ever to get caught up in, is this true, is this not true?
Yeah.
The beauty of any kind of a posture like that is, how far does it take me?
Yeah.
If I ride this particular horse, do I advance? If I don't ride this particular horse, am I just walking in place and going nowhere? And you'll find with most belief systems is you're going nowhere.
Well, exactly.
So the idea is to see if you cannot shift the point from which you view, regardless of whether or not you buy into it or don't buy into it, see where it takes you. If it takes you nowhere, discard it. If you like where it takes you, continue for a while. Nothing will ever take you to the end of the journey, because there is no end to the journey.
Yes, exactly so.
You know, they talk about in Zen, having a Zen mind, which is clearing your mind. And then people that are following that discipline, they sit for hours, days on end, and they watch what comes up. They watch what comes up in their mind, and they just let it go, and they watch what comes up in their mind. And theoretically, eventually, they become empty. And
well, I don't think that's true.
There is this dark night of the soul that you have to pass through, because then there's the fear of the void that comes up. And so, what if all there is that darkness and the void? And then people have to go through that. And they hold through that, and on the other side of that, there is that experience of joy and energy and what people call God or divine presence moving through your body. And then you start to see other people, and then you see them in that same presence. You see through their temptation of themselves. You just see right through it, and you see them, and you see their energy going through them. They see it's the same energy that's animating them as you. And then if you're in really good shape, you share energy. You don't share energy by trying, it just happens. And you experience this oneness with the other being. And I think that's kind of the stages a person has to go through to get there. And I think the hardest part of the stage is that portion where they are taking their first foot into the void, when they let go of the familiar things, and suddenly there's fear comes up. Fear is right in front of their face as they step into the void, because they don't know that on the other side of that void, there is an oasis. There is joy. They don't know it. Even when you hear it, even when people tell you, I mean, you say, well, he said it, but how do I know? Maybe I'll be the guy that never gets through it. I'll fall into the void and never come out. And so
I don't know, Wynn. You know, I think everybody's different.
Everybody's different. Everybody's process is different.
I mean, yeah, yeah.
I don't think this. I mean, I know personally quite a few people that have gone through the kind of way that I'm describing it, this model. You know, everyone's different, goes through different things.
Mm-hmm.
And some people come in, for example, without maybe a lot of shadow side from their past lives. They come in more clean. And so they don't have such a big void to go through. Like, I don't think Jean-Claude.
Well, I have one question for you, Wynn. Where in God's name did you go wrong?
Where did I go wrong? You know, Don, I'm not the guest tonight. Jean-Claude is.
That's right, and that's why I'm asking.
If you ask me that, it's a long story.
Well, actually, I was asking you that because that was the title of something that Jean-Claude recently wrote, and I read it, and I read it again, and I thought, wow.
What was the title? Where did Wynn go wrong?
Where in God's name did we go wrong?
Uh-huh.
And he was touched on a little about that as his, he was speaking. But what a powerful write-up, Jean. I mean, the articles that you have on your website and this new one is incredible because you kind of – you put it in layman's terms. You make it so easy for people to just, that's your style of writing, just like going deeper. You follow it along and you get engrossed in it, and away you go on a journey that you don't forget. And it's like your writing is like an adventure.
Oh, thank you. That's really, really sweet. I appreciate that a lot. What happens is I've gone through, because of my business life before I did all the metaphysical stuff in writing, probably wrote about 2 to 3 million words in marketing reports. And I'm told that after the third millionth word, it starts flowing a little easier. And then what happens is I then work with a very highly skilled editor by the name of Carolyn Bond. And she makes me justify every single word and comma that stays on a page. So a simple article of 1,000 words that some people do in one draft can take 2 to 3 weeks of editing.
Wow.
Back and forth to get it really right, to create that illusion of simplicity.
Well, it works because a good editor, though, is hard to find. When you get a good one, it's amazing because I've heard stories about editors. And
I'm very blessed. She is not only phenomenal at her craft, but she comes from a very strong tradition of the Upanishads and the Vedantas and the entire Indian philosophy. That she brings to the table.
Wow.
So that when we speak and when we play in a playground, it's large enough to hold at least the kinds of universes that I play in. So I'm blessed and thank you.
Well, when, you know, the way you wrote it about, being God-fearing folk and people, you know, they take their relationship, with God so seriously that they end up separating themselves from who they really are. Not only are they separating themselves from God, but they're actually separating themselves from who they really are, which inevitably is one and the same thing. And it starts with that separation. And you go into that so well about, putting labels. Everything's got a label, or it has a name, and God has this name. And once you give him a name, you know, you've now, I guess segregated God, because you've then formed an identity that is no longer your own.
Oh, exactly. Anything that you name creates distance between you and the object name. You create a subject-object relationship. The article talks about where in God's name did we go wrong, and it begins by asking the question that people ask me all the time: are you religious? And invariably I answer, course not. I love God much too much.
Right.
And then they would say to me, well, then of course you believe in God. And I would say, absolutely not. Does a fish believe in water? There is only God. What is there to believe? There's nothing about me that requires belief to feel the presence of God. There is only God. There is nothing in my ken, in my perception, that exists outside of the concept of God.
Yes.
And what the article talks about as well is experiences that I've had in my life. I remember when I was at Finhorn, and I was in orientation week, and we were sitting around in a large circle, and a young man by the name of Peter, all of a sudden, in the middle of nowhere, just exclaimed, "My God, I've got it!" And the facilitator looked at him and said, "Yes, Peter, what do you have?" And Peter said, "I really see it. It is not that God is in all things. It's that God is all things." And it, like, knocked me back about 40 feet. And the facilitator, focusing totally on his agenda, said, "Why, Peter, thank you for sharing. Does anybody else have anything else that they want to share?"
Right.
And never, probably to this day, understood the vast import of what this young man had to say. And what it did for me, that the article talks about as well, is it put together something Buckminster Fuller said. And his claim was that it seems to me that God is a verb, not a noun. And I had no idea what that meant, but there was something about it that was so profound that it lodged forever in my mind. It seems to me that God is a verb, not a noun.
Yes.
And then when Peter said what he did, all of a sudden, the penny dropped, and I went, oh my God, I got it. God is not the creator. We have it totally wrong. God and the creation are one. There
yes.
is no cause and effect. There is only God. It is the absolute unfoldment of infinite creation itself. Now, if you shift the point from which you view and see God not as a noun, but as a verb, and see that everything is God, that when you listen, it's with God's ears. When someone else speaks to you, it is with God's mouth. When you see a bird, it is God in flight. A tree is God giving shade and changing the atmosphere and showing beauty. Everything, manifest or no, is an aspect of the oneness. Now, when you shift the point from which you view to see it that way, everything about your life and your reality changes in a New York minute.
You know, that's exactly what they talk about when, you know, how the Power of Now, which is a wonderful book, he talks about living in the moment, and what you describe is akin to how he describes feeling or being as he lives in the moment, because everything's new. Everything's that unfoldment of all there is.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. It's in going deeper, there's the parable, the famous Janus parable about the six blind men and the elephant. And they all walk up to the elephant, and each touches a different part,
right,
leading it to be a completely different animal. One thinks that, you know, the tusk, it's a sharp knife-like animal. Another holds the leg and thinks it's like a tree. One holds the tail and thinks it's like a snake, and so on. But that's the nature of philosophy, metaphysics, and perception. We all are blind men groping in the infinite mystery,
right,
attempting to come up with something that makes sense to us in the moment. And hopefully, having the sense to realize it was, no matter when we say it, it was yesterday's truth. And not to hold on to it as a sibilant, not make it our little teddy bear that we cuddle up with at night. I tell myself every night when I go to sleep believing something, if I wake up in the morning believing the same thing, no big deal. I'm stuck. And if I insist others believe what I believe, then I'm in trouble because now I'm a bigot.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and that's exactly what the word means.
Yes.
And so it's about watching ourselves and being able to untangle within ourselves our perception and beginning to realize our perceptions are broken into three different categories. We just need to be aware of what they are, what we believe, which is stuff that was handed down to us by others who truly do not know. What we think, stuff we've worked out in our own minds, and we think things are supposed to be a particular way. And things we actually know. And what we know is virtually nothing. And when we realize that we can have that empty cup that Wynne talked about before and move into that space of emptiness, there's nothing to defend. There's nothing to hold on to. We should embrace emptiness as the greatest potential for learning, because it's not preconditioned with the way the lesson has to be in order to validate what we thought we already believed.
I love the way you put that. Because it's true, you can really fit things into three categories, belief, thinking, and knowing. And really, when it comes right down to it, I look at it as a journey. If you can eat what you take, and just like you say, what you take, you can experience it the way you perceive it in that moment, but then you gotta realize that, that isn't any absolute, and you step back from it, and you know that it can change, and that it is changing, and everything's always changing is one big, great expression.
Absolutely. Incidentally, much of what we're talking about is in the book. The subtitle of the book, Going Deeper, is How to Make Sense of Your Life When Your Life Makes No Sense. And for the listeners that are on board with us, if you've ever gotten to the point where you look at your life and say, you know what, I'm living someone else's dream. I'm marching in someone else's parade. There's got to be more to what I'm doing now. There's got to be something deeper. I'm missing something. The book deals specifically with that and was written primarily for the 70 million wanderers. These are beings that have come down from much higher levels of awareness, much higher densities, to take incarnation on Earth to help with the shift that's happening now. If any part of you feels that this may be talking to you, please, please, please go to the website, which is goingdeeper.org, O-R-G, goingdeeper.org. All the articles that we're talking about are up on the website for you to read. The first two chapters of the book are there for you to read. And if the book intrigues you and you want to go a little bit deeper into it, into this crazy mystery we're living, use the promotion code, either the promotion code DON or the promotion code WYNN, D-O-N or W-Y-N-N, and you will get a 50% discount on the purchase of the book.
Oh, amazing. Amazing.
Wow.
Thank you. You know, people, you really should take advantage of that, because I personally read Going Deeper, and it was one of the two books that started me on my journey. And had the most impact, and I just encourage everyone to pick it up, because go to his website and read a few articles. You're going to find the style of his writing is not only incredible, but it's really easy to understand, because so many books, and I've read, and I'm sure you have, Jean, books that, you know, tongue twist you. I mean, trying to get through A Course in Miracles, which I did, and I read it and reread it and underlined it and studied it, and I went through the other second book, the workbook, and never did get into the third, unfortunately, but because I figured I never knew the first well enough. They tongue twist you. They're just there. It's not as simple as you might think, or they don't make it as simple, unfortunately, but your book lays it out and it gives the reader a real journey. And what they get out of it, I think the most important thing they get out of it is the fact that they really don't know anything. Not only do they not know anything, but life is a much greater and grander mystery and journey than they could have ever thought.
Hear, hear. Let me share something with you, if I may. I was with a magnificent artist that totally blew my mind, some of his work, Lee McCloskey, the other day. And in his studio, looking at his artwork and being in discourse with him, something popped up in realization, to realize that the primal focus of all creation is lust. There's a tremendous lust for creation. And I've been trying to work for months, literally, on understanding sexuality. Not in the usual pathway that it's usually, you know, spirituality and sexuality, isn't it wonderful? We can use this
right
to get to God. But something beyond that, much, much deeper than that. So I'm playing with an article, and finally I got the opening line to the article that I'm using right now, just to give you an idea of where I'm coming from. And it goes something like this. According to an irrefutable and as yet undiscovered ancient text, sex is better than chocolate.
No way, is that it?
So, you know what? Don is not going to disagree with you on that one.
And I got to tell you, I absolutely love chocolate. Well, I'm not denigrating chocolate. I'm just elevating sex.